ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
There is a man hurrying down the street, his eyes fixed ahead and his coat swinging as his feet hit the pavement. As a train whistle sounds, steam rises, and in the shadows, someone is watching.
They see him getting onto the 7:42 train from Slough to London. They're not quite in time to prevent him getting on the train, but they see him and they see which carriage he gets into.
As he sits down, his heart thumps. He breathes deep because he's made it. He has outrun his past. Except little does he know that his past isn't behind him at all. In fact, it's racing alongside him and will wait for him at the next station. All thanks to a futuristic machine.
It's kind of playing a role in the capture of a wrongdoer or an evil person. A really sort of good demonstration of the capacity of this new technology.
I'm Mark Fennell, and this is the story of a murder and a strange new technology that helped catch a killer before anyone really understood what it could do. A machine that would go on to change the world, but at the time, no one saw it coming. So, let's start with this. Happy New Year. It is the 1st of January, 1845, and right now you're in front of an unassuming row of cottages in Slough, which is about an hour west of London.
And we are sitting in a room and the walls are not very thick. And we're hearing from kind of the next door house a series of cries and moans. And we do what anyone would do. We rush out of our house.
This is writer, cultural historian and good friend of the show, Cassia Sinclair.
We see our neighbour, who's called Sarah Hart. She's lying on the floor, her clothes disarranged, her skirt sort of up above her knee, one shoe's off, one stocking is down by her ankle. And she is sort of moaning and crying. This woman, who's her neighbour, lifts her up. And as she does so, sort of foam starts dripping out of her mouth. It must have been incredibly distressing. A doctor is called and several other neighbours come because of the noise. But the moment the doctor arrives, it's very clear that Sarah has died.
When Sarah's body goes still and her screams stop, a silence falls on the house. The doctors and neighbours look around to see what could possibly have caused her this agony. And then they notice something on the table.
There's a half-empty glass of what looks like beer and a bottle of beer next to it. And so this liquid that she'd very clearly been consuming just before her death comes under immediate suspicion as the cause of death.
Because it turns out that something was put in that beer that definitely should not have been there.
What has been slipped into this glass of beer that Sarah had been drinking is a treatment for varicose veins. It contains a lot of prussic acid, and this acid is what had been used to kill her.
Now, prussic acid, you might know it by its more familiar name, hydrogen cyanide, which, if you've ever read Agatha Christie, is never a great sign. It's a poison. It's fast, it's brutal, and it stops your body from using oxygen. So in effect, you suffocate even while you are still breathing.
And thoughts immediately turn to murder, particularly given the fact that a man was walking out of the property, you know, as the screams were first heard.
In the ruckus, Sarah's neighbours spotted a man leaving her cottage when they went round to check on her. And unfortunately for him, his fashion choices made him pretty memorable.
all the kind of contemporary reports of him say that he's dressed like a Quaker. And in 19th century terms, that meant usually black or white or sometimes brown clothing. He was wearing a long greatcoat, but he was also wearing a kind of distinctively Quaker hat. And that meant a kind of broad-brimmed hat. This is kind of this is what really catches people's attention at the time. And that's the kind of how they perceive this man who's seen walking away from the scene of the crime and towards the station.
So who is it that chases after him to the train station? Do we know that?
So the next door neighbour is a woman. I think she's called Mrs. Chapman. And she then calls another neighbour who sort of comes round immediately afterwards in the wake of all this, you know, this commotion. And he is a chaplain. And he is the one who actually physically runs after or chases after and sees him get on the train. Rather than being completely helpless, they go to the station master's office, and the station master uses an early system of the telegraph to telegraph ahead to the station at Paddington.
So if you want to picture what a telegraph machine was like at the time, it's less modern technology, almost looks closer to a handcrafted bit of furniture. You've got a small device mounted on a wooden base. There's exposed brass and iron parts and wires that are wrapped in cloth. And then you've got this very simple metal key that you press by hand. It's connected to a metal arm that moves up and down and sends short and long pulses and patterns, allowing operators to spell out messages using Morse code. It's a great little gadget, but at the time this is all happening, 1845, the general public didn't really get why they needed it. The postal services in Great Britain had recently been made much easier and much cheaper, and the consensus seemed to be, why would you need a message to travel faster than a letter?
It's primarily being used in the UK by the railway system. So it's quite useful for railways to be able to let one another know if a train's late or if there's been some kind of accident or, you know, a breakdown on lines and so on and so forth. It really cuts down on train accidents. So they do start kind of proliferating through the UK, through railway stations. And it also, this is going to sound really odd, but also at this time you have kind of local time, so the time in London is not the same as the time in Slough. The time is sort of done by sundials locally, but that's not very useful if you're trying to set up a railway system. And so the railway system, not only is it kind of an early adopter of the telegraph system, but it also uses the telegraph to kind of set the clocks, and there's kind of like British railway time as well as local time.
So the Slough train station master has just been told that there is a man on the train to Paddington that may have just murdered a woman. And so with shaking hands, he taps out a telegram.
And so this message that is sent, I can actually read it to you verbatim. I've got my notes open here. So it said, a murder has just been committed at Salt Hill, and the suspected murderer was seen to take a first-class ticket to London by the train which left Slough at 7:42 p.m. He is in the garb of a Quaker with a greatcoat on, which reaches nearly down to his feet. He is in the last compartment of first class compartment.
I would have just gone, murderer on the district line. Come on.
Yeah, you can tell this is early on. You can tell this is early use of technology. They really haven't kind of nailed it. And brevity was not the strong suit. I mean, using the word compartment twice, it's a long word. That must have taken quite some time.
As the man makes his way to London, this message races alongside him to actually beat him there. So the train journey takes about an hour, which sounds like plenty of time for this information to get to Paddington. Because I think when we imagine a message travelling through an electronic wire, I think we kind of imagine it being instantaneous. The thing is, with telegraph technology, it was certainly fast, but the message itself took longer because, remember, it has to be transmitted, but then it also has to be received.
I'm not entirely sure what the kind of letter or word per minute rate was at this time, but kind of, so I think it's something like 3 letters per minute. So it's really quite slow. And this message, you know, it's long-winded. So I think it would have taken a relatively long time to transmit, you know, successfully.
So transmitting 3 letters per minute, which is not exactly speedy. But then once the message is received, it has to be deciphered, which again takes even more time.
Apparently, you know, I don't know whether how much of this is newspaper sensationalism, but apparently it did take them a little while to work out what Quaker meant because it was spelt with a K.
So not only has Slough sent through a very long message, they've also sent it through with typos, because apparently the model of telegram machine at the Slough station was not great.
This early model is a little bit unusual. It doesn't have all the letters. So now we think of the telegraph system as being kind of, you know, using Morse code and being a system of dots and dashes. But this was a really early system. And so the interface actually would have been kind of quite a sort of a grand, almost like a board, like a sort of a game of Risk or like a Ouija board. And it had a sort of series of needles that would point to different letters, but it didn't have all the letters of the alphabet. It didn't have a J, it didn't have a Q, and it didn't have a Z.
In the message, Quaker is spelt with a K and the word just is spelt with a G. Anyway, it's safe to say that the team at Paddington have their work cut out for them in receiving, and I suppose more importantly, understanding the message from Slough. While all this is happening, though, that man is sitting comfortably on the train, watching the scenery outside, completely unaware of the urgent tapping and deciphering happening. But who exactly was he? And why would he want to poison Sarah Hart?
Very quickly, it is determined that the person who was seen leaving her house at the time of her death in this kind of Quaker garb is a man called John Tarrell. He had kind of a checkered career. When he was a young man, he'd been arrested for forgery and initially sentenced to death. The crime had been committed while he was working for a bank. The bank was a Quaker organization. Quakers did not believe in the death penalty. And so the bank had pleaded on his behalf. And so his death sentence had been overturned and changed to exile to Australia. So he'd been sent to Australia to serve out this sentence.
Yes, as was the norm at the time, England sent its criminals and crooks to the Antipodes, landing them down under to start brand new lives, as was the case for John, and family life as well.
The bank had then sort of kept on petitioning on his behalf. His sentence had been reduced. After a few years, he is released. He marries, he becomes a clerk, and then has his own kind of shops and selling sort of pharmaceutical goods. He has two children, and after a few years, he moves back to London.
Then in 1831, John and his family are back in London, and it doesn't take long for the noisy, crowded, dirty city to take its toll. Within a few years, John's sons get sick and die. And then his wife falls ill as well. John needs help looking after her, so he hires a nurse. A nurse with the name Sarah Hart.
And Sarah and John begin an affair.
That affair leads to two more children. And then in 1838, John's sick wife, she dies. And suddenly, John and Sarah seem quite happy together. Until he meets another woman.
He meets a Quaker widow. It's very inconvenient if you are wooing a Quaker widow to have your lover and her two children around. So he sets Sarah up in this house in Slough and pays her child maintenance around about £1 a week. And he visits her regularly to hand over the money.
£1 in 1840 is around £90 in today's money. And very quickly, this starts to add up for John. He finds himself a bit strapped for cash. So he decides that something's got to give. And unlike a normal person who might, talk to Sarah about his financial situation.
He clearly decides to murder Sarah. You know, it's definitely premeditated.
John buys the acid. He sneaks it into Sarah's beer and poisons her before rushing to the train station and heading to London.
And that probably would have been it. He probably would have gotten away with it because, you know, Slough and London, although it's, you know, only an hour apart, he could have, you know, taken off his coat while he was on the train, taken off his hat, and no one would have been any the wiser. However, Slough Station in 1845 had a relatively new invention, which was the sort of an early model system of the telegraph.
And it was on that machine that the long misspelled message that a potential murderer was headed to London was sent on. It was finally deciphered on the other end, and the police were called. The sergeant lands on the platform and he waits for John's train. But, in case you're picturing this, he's not standing there with a whistle and handcuffs in hand. No, no. He doesn't want to cause a scene. In fact, the sergeant was wearing a coat over his uniform so as not to arouse suspicion and alarm. The train pulls into the station. John steps onto the platform and he sees the policeman, who looks straight back at him. John fits the description of the telegram perfectly. This is the guy, the policeman thinks. And then John walks straight past him and out of the station.
Rather than arresting him on the platform, they decide to tail him.
They follow the Quaker man out of the train station onto a horse-drawn bus and into the city. The sergeant sits in the conductor's seat, and John, when he gets off, he apparently hands him a fare.
John gets off, he kind of wanders around, he visits a sweet shop, and then he wanders to his home, which is relatively near Bank. It's just a few streets away.
Subtly, the sergeant follows John all the way to his home. It's not until the next day that the police arrest him for the murder of Sarah Hart. He protests, "Yeah, I wasn't in Slough," but the sergeant replies, "Yes, you were, sir. You got out of the train, onto a bus, and you gave me sixpence." And with that, John is put on trial.
It's pretty much an open and shut case. So the lawyer for the defence, you know, is really up against it. Some of the evidence heard is kind of, you know, post-mortem. They did kind of multiple rounds with different kind of testing out different poisons. They ascertained that it was definitely prussic acid that had killed Sarah by doing this kind of the autopsy.
The acid in Sarah's system is damning evidence. John's defence is kind of cornered by it. And that's when they come up with this wild argument.
You have this defence barrister who's called Sir Fitzroy Kelly, and his first words to the jury in defence of his client are apple pips. And he argues the crime was committed on New Year's Day, or she died rather on New Year's Day in the way that he presented it. And he argued that she'd eaten loads of apples over the kind of the festive period, so many apples that she'd essentially overdosed on the kind of the naturally occurring prussic acid in apple pips. But this was just not, this could not be taken seriously. And it's said that he kind of, because of this kind of slightly ridiculous defense, he kind of earned the nickname of Apple Pip Kelly later on in his career.
So the jury don't buy it. What did the jury decide to do with Towel?
So he is sentenced to death. And on this occasion, you know, there is no Quaker organization coming to his defense. And he is executed in front of a crowd of 10,000 people.
10,000 people is a lot. So I'm assuming there's a lot of public interest in the case. How is it being covered in the newspapers?
So newspapers at this time are really enjoying a boom. It's a really sort of exciting time for newspapers. And one of the things that really shifts newspapers are kind of, you know, then as now, are big, juicy crimes. They absolutely love a crime. They love a murder. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. And this was one of those stories that really captured people's imaginations. And, you know, it's perfect for the age. You've got this, you know, atrocious murder, which always sells newspapers. You've got the kind of the female victim who, you know, who's sort of, you know, morally ambiguous or grey. And that was, you know, something that newspapers really enjoyed at the time, you know, sort of kind of suggesting that her death, her end, was a product of her lifestyle or her life choices. You also have this idea that progress can defeat crime, or the kind of inexorable triumph of progress. And this is something that newspapers really enjoyed too. And so this particular crime, this particular story, has real appeal to newspapers of the age. And they make a lot of the kind of the role of the telegraph. It's the sort of the role of progress, the role of science, having this kind of ability to kind of almost create a kind of godlike effect. You know, the fact that man, reasonable, intellectual man, can with their inventions kind of foil a crime is really kind of a compelling narrative.
The arrest of John and his execution and the hype around it really helped the everyday person understand the power of the telegraph. It captured people's imagination, showed them that sending information faster than a letter on a train or on a horse or by foot can in fact have a huge impact.
Stories like this, that almost kind of act like parables and are really kind of easy to grasp, the role of technology, and are kind of widely transmitted because they're, you know, they're about murder and they're kind of juicy and salacious, do have a surprising impact on the way that people perceive these new technologies. No longer is it just like boring train timetables and helping to overcome the kind of idiosyncrasies of local time. It's kind of playing a role in the capture of a wrongdoer or an evil person. And that's really compelling. It's kind of a really sort of good demonstration of the capacity of this new technology.
So when you look at this, what do you think is the most important thing that changed people's perceptions?
So I think it's one of those things where the success of the Telegram, I think, was already assured. There are so many forces pushing it forward, but time is a big one. The fact that you can relay, you know, accurate time around a country, but also around the world, is really key. You know, within a few years, particularly after the telegraph has spread globally, you know, astronomers at Greenwich Mean Time are able to transmit time across the world and kind of standardize time. You also have, you know, big financial interests. The fact that once you lay a cable between America and the UK, and basically these cables crisscross the world, and suddenly you're able to send financial information, you know, across the world relatively quickly. And that's really exciting for people. There's lots of practical applications, but there's also a real kind of draw for the Victorian imagination, particularly the kind of colonial British imagination, for this kind of network of cables.
In 1870, the telegraph industry was nationalised and in fact actually became part of the British Post Office. By 1875, there were cables that linked Britain to America, India, Europe, the Far East, and yes, indeed, as far as Australia. In England, they likened it, the telegraph system, to a nervous system.
And this is very compelling to the Victorian mind, particularly the British mind, because they see themselves as like the nerve centre, the brain, and the kind of their influence is spreading out across the world. They love that. And you get this kind of standardisation of time, you get kind of the ability to react very quickly, particularly to unrest. Again, you know, that's very helpful in colonial contexts. You also get the, you know, in very large countries like America, like Australia, like, you know, the Russian Empire, for example, it's really, really, really helpful to be able to send messages from one end of the country to the other. It really helps bring a country together and rule it, but also kind of administer it far more seamlessly and makes it feel much more cohesive. And it really has this effect of like shrinking the world. Another sort of metaphor that's used is that the telegraph system has leveled the world, and now all of mankind is sort of standing on one plane because you have this ability to get in touch with people really quickly and really seamlessly.
It's funny, we live in an age of instantaneous communication, and right now you're in London, I'm in Sydney, and we have this easy conversation, which is of course the product of our modern age. What strikes me about this story is that this incident is kind of one of those crucial inklings of what the future would become. Certainly not the only one by any stretch of the imagination, but the fact that it becomes public and it becomes written up in the newspapers, I think it's what stands out to me is that it's a moment where the public get to imagine the future that you and I are now literally, quite literally, living.
No, I really agree. I think this story is really appealing to me in kind of being a story that allows people to imagine the future and kind of is popular and widespread and has this kind of surprisingly subtle but powerful impact on public perception of a new technology and allows people to kind of throw out the possibilities of a technology into a kind of wider sphere.
Yeah, there's a great phrase, I can't remember who actually said it, but it's like a writer and engineer that described the telegraph as annihilating space and time.
Yeah, you know, I think there have been lots of kind of ways in which people either like to see the telegraph at the time or now like to reflect on its impact. You know, people have talked about it as being like the Victorian internet. People have liked to talk about it as like, you know, annihilating or flattening space or time. It was really exciting to people, this capacity to transmit information instantaneously, you know, particularly in America. The very first kind of telegraph message sent kind of using the telegraph system in America was, "Look what God hath wrought." You know, there was this feeling that like this was miraculous and really significant, and it must have felt quite godlike.
Cassia, thank you so much. This has been amazing.
Great. Well, I'm really pleased to tell the story. It's an amazing, well, it's very sad, but it's an amazing story. And these kind of stories that help explain the, you know, a new technology, I think are so compelling.
writer and cultural historian Cassia Sinclair there. And if you want to hear other stories that Cassia's told us, we will link them in the show notes. There's a really great one about how bra makers helped put Neil Armstrong on the moon. It's a fabulous episode. And of course, this episode was produced by Zoe Ferguson and Rebecca Metcalf, and the sound design was by Angie Grant. We love hearing from you. I know I say it every week, but I do mean it. If you'd like to get in touch and let us know a story you'd like us to cover or just some feedback, please do. We actually read every single bit of it. No one saw it coming at abc.net.au. Of course, this show is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. I'm Mark Fennell. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.